Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Apple just stepped into a hot debate around ad blocking. Its new mobile operating system lets you download apps that block ads. For large portions of the web that rely on revenue from ads, from YouTube to the New York Times, billions of dollars are at stake. And ad blocking isn't the only challenge. Bots that fake traffic, mobile devices where advertising can seem intrusive, are making it harder for websites to cash in. This hour on Point, ad blocking, bots, mobile, and the challenge to the very economic underpinnings of much of the web. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you installed an ad blocker on your browser? Do you run a website that depends on advertising revenue? How does all this add up, or does it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Los Angeles is Tim Peterson, digital reporter for Ad Age. He's been closely following the whole debate. Tim, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Happy Monday, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For having me.
Good to have you. So how has Apple's announcement come into this world of people who depend on ads to support their online presence?
Yeah, it's really shaken things up. You know, ad blocking has been an issue on desktop for years, but it was always there was always the feeling that it was a self-selecting group and, you know, somewhat of a minority. But now there have been studies by Adobe and Pagefair, you know, pegging the number at upwards of 200 million, although it's questionable whether that's just people who have installed ad blockers or are currently using them. But it's with Apple coming into the fore, as, you know, with anything Apple does, has really made the issue the primary dilemma facing publishers today.
Tim, we'll have a lot of listeners who may have been using ad blockers for years, others who may be getting into it just now as Apple makes noise about it and makes it easier. Describe how they work.
Yeah, so with Apple, how it works is you install an app on your phone, and then you go and you select to use that as an extension when you're using Apple's mobile Safari browser. It only works in Apple's mobile Safari browser. So if you're using Chrome or another browser, the ad blocking won't work. But so then you enable that, and then any websites that you visit, you should see those pages load without any ads. There are even options to disable trackers, which are these little pieces of code that can identify that you visited, say, ESPN.com, and then that lets an ad company know that you're interested in sports, maybe you're a guy, you're probably in the U.S., things of that nature.
So I slap an ad blocker on, and the next time I go to YouTube, I don't have to wait for that, whatever it is, Clorox ad before I watch the cute kitty.
Yes, correct.
That's a pretty big deal. I mean, on YouTube these days, you can wait at lots of places to see what you want to see. Hillary Clinton on Saturday Night Live, that little clip from just last weekend, whatever it may be, you're going to get to your content quicker. And it's not just getting rid of the ad. It's also less data being downloaded and faster load times for, I guess, most everything you're doing.
Yes, usually that's the case. Sometimes on desktop, some of the ad blockers can actually add to the time that a page needs to load because of all the processes they need to do in order to determine which ads are trying to be served and block those ads. But the New York Times had a great study last week showing that on mobile, page load speeds, you know, went down by a significant margin, and the amount of data needed to load a page also went down. Oftentimes, that's because a lot of the ads that get loaded are very heavy, you know, video ads, photos. I often think of it, you know, if you think of the size of a Word document on your computer compared to the size of a photo or a video file. That's sort of the similar analogy here.
It must give the New York Times heartburn to have to report that, because they, like many others, are looking at a digital future where ad revenue online surely plays a big part in their survival.
It's very disconcerting, I think, for any ad-supported publisher today.
Here's a little bit from, this is from Adblock Plus, a little video from their site about, you know, how easy it is.
After the installation, all annoying ads are automatically removed from any website. You're now free to browse the web without any annoying ads showing. Adblock Plus is open source and completely free. It's simple to use and 100% secure.
with a little gentle guitar music in the background. Meanwhile, you've got people's visions of the future going up in flames here. Describe for a moment why Apple would do this. Where does their interest lie here? They just want a better user experience, or is this somehow part of a strategic competition?
Yeah, the consensus opinion seems to be that this is a shot directly at Google, who makes 90-91% of its revenue from advertising. Meanwhile, Apple makes a very, very minor percentage of its revenue from advertising. Apple has come out, and Tim Cook has made a couple speeches this year talking about the importance of privacy and positioning Apple as the privacy-friendly company, implicitly positioning Google as not a privacy-friendly company. And so that seems to be one of the motivations here, along with just the idea of less data being used, a better experience for its users, which is always Apple's MO.
I mean, e-commerce goes right on, really unaffected by this in most ways, I suppose. But if Apple really delivers a blow to all those sites online that are information, BuzzFeed and all the rest, that aren't selling stuff, I mean, are they risking destroying the village in order to save it or to save their competitive position here, Tim?
That's certainly a big concern. And actually, e-commerce companies aren't immune from this. Okay. They use a lot of the same types of ad technology on their websites, in order to do things like recognize which products are in your shopping cart or recommend products that you might be interested in based on things that you've browsed in the past. So it's actually put a damper on their businesses as well.
People are feeling beleaguered on other fronts as well, not just ad blockers, but bots. These are these little bots that run around the web and appear to create traffic, so that if I'm paying per set of eyeballs that fall on my ad, bots can come and artificially drive that way up, even if very few humans are actually looking at my ad.
Yes. Yeah, and bots are, it's interesting because bots are a compounding problem with ad blocking, because for advertisers and publishers, in order to filter out bot traffic to make sure that an advertiser is only paying for ads that can be seen by actual people, they use ad technology in order to verify that fact. But that ad technology is exactly the kind of ad technology that the ad blockers disable.
Tim, who's most vulnerable? If ad blockers kick in even more deeply, and they've been around for a while, but they appear to have a fresh head of steam on, if these really get going, more and more people install them, who's most at risk?
I would say long-tail publishers, those publishers that don't have a closer relationship with their advertisers in order to be able to do things like BuzzFeed, where they create custom advertorials for an advertiser that can kind of sidestep these problems, or also publishers that can't afford to pay companies like AdBlock Plus, one of the major AdBlock providers. Companies like Google, Amazon, Microsoft reportedly pay AdBlock Plus in order to let their ads through, to give them a pass. Many smaller publishers wouldn't be able to do so.
That's kind of wild. It's like they're putting a gun to your head. You'll pay up or lose your ad revenue.
It certainly feels like extortion.
What kind of solutions seem most promising to people in the business? I know that big Ad Week conference has been going on last week in New York. How big a deal is this, and where are people turning?
It's a massive deal. There are a couple different options that people are exploring. One is this idea of native advertising, what in the past, when it comes to magazines, we called advertorials, but things where a brand will go to a BuzzFeed or New York Times and say, hey, write an article for us, for our brand. This is the message we want to get across. And then that'll go up on BuzzFeed site with the brand's logo, et cetera. The brand can have input. Sometimes the brand can even be creating the content. Those types of things generally can't be blocked by an ad blocker. Other options are there are technology companies that can actually detect when ads are being blocked and deliver a message to the end user saying, hey, we see that you have an ad blocker on. Would you mind turning it off? This is how we make money. Or would you mind paying if you don't want to see ads? That way we can keep investing in the content that you like to read.
I mean, there must be limits for news organizations in particular about how far they can go on this advertorial or native advertising path. If people, I've seen it with those little labels on it that say this is from, you know, sponsored by or this is from, but you get too much of that on a news site and pretty soon it feels just like one big ad, not a news site.
Right. Although on the flip side of that, then you think about Facebook, and these are exactly the types of ads that you see on Facebook, and Facebook makes about $4 billion every 3 months from these types of ads.
Oh, that's not too bad. that's not too bad. So people sort of freaking out here, looking for alternative paths. You've got even some networks beginning to look at installing this. I read some network based out of Jamaica, but with the global reach, it's installing ad blocking across its entire user network.
Yes, yes. They're and similar to Adblock Plus, this network, Digicel, who has 13.6 million customers in the Caribbean and South Pacific, is issued a release last week saying, specifically pointing to Google, Facebook, and Yahoo, saying, we're going to start blocking your ads because they take up a lot of data on our networks in order to serve them, and we don't get any money from that. So we're going to block them unless Google, Facebook, Yahoo, you start paying us to let this through. It's sort of this idea that companies like Digicel have created all these pipes on which companies like Google and Facebook are profiting, and now Digicel wants a part of a piece of those profits.
Tim, are we going to recognize the internet, I don't know, 5-6 years from now if ad blocking becomes the norm?
That's certainly a very good question. Yeah, the idea of the open web very much comes into question, at least the idea of the open web as a place in which individual content creators can subsidize their own lives comes very much into question.
The internet disrupting itself this time. Tim Peterson, digital reporter for Ad Age, has been with us from Los Angeles. Tim, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about ad blocking, bots, and mobile itself as mounting economic challenges to key players, lots of players, on the internet, and in particular to sites that may bring you your news. You see them all over the web. Here's just one example of many, an ad that comes up on YouTube, in this case before a video from This Old House.
For those who cook, we present a flame. Not just any flame, a flame that distributes heat evenly, so you can cook beautifully. And it's just one piece of one part of the revolutionary new kitchen from KitchenAid.
Okay, maybe you don't want to hear about their revolutionary new kitchen, but do you want to see This Old House? What's going to pay the freight if the ad's not there? Ad people and internet publishers all in a swivet about this. Here at the Advertising Week conference in New York last week, this is Sridhar Ramaswamy, Google's top advertising exec, saying that terrible user ad experiences are behind the uptick in ad blocking tools, that Google, along with the ad and publishing industries, need to come up with a different way.
We need to recognize as an industry that this is something that we need to deal with. So this is where we need to work together, for example, to come up with a definition of what an acceptable ad is and what an acceptable ads program could be.
Can that be done? What would that look like? Or does the whole thing come crashing down, at least as we've known it? Joining me now in the studio is Sinan Aral, professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, where he co-leads the initiative on the digital economy. Sounds like what we need to learn. Sinan Aral, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from New York is Rebecca Lieb. She's a consultant, research analyst, author focused on digital marketing and media. Clients have included Facebook and Home Depot and Pinterest. Rebecca in New York. Rebecca Lieb, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Big problem or just an internet, you know, tempest in a teapot, Rebecca?
I think this is potentially a big problem. One of the major problems is programmatic advertising. As you said, ads that are not really congruent with a good user experience. And this has been compounded on mobile devices where ads are even more intrusive and interruptive.
Because the screen's so small to begin with.
There's less real estate. Mm-hmm. Very much so. But, you know, I think that if this whole ad blocking debate could have an advertising tagline, it would be ad blockers, they're not just for geeks anymore. This has been around for about 15 years, but in the form of very configurable hardware and software software that was really used by people who knew their way around browser plugins and software. Apple has put this in the hands of the masses, and of course anything that Apple does gets all kinds of publicity, and there's a halo amplification effect that is going to be alerting a lot of consumers to the fact that ad blocking is now going to be as easy on their phones and on their desktop computers as it has long been on their television sets. These are consumers with DVRs who haven't been watching commercials in quite some time as well.
The message, come on in, it's easy, the water's fine. It can sound kind of geeky, but how dramatically could it affect the landscape of what's out there on the web, Rebecca?
The commercial internet is financed by advertising. There has always been that traditional value exchange with, if you watch our ads, whether you're print or broadcast media, we will continue to supply you with content. And there has been a huge shift away from that value exchange because consumers are increasingly in control, which is why advertisers, and I'm currently researching this topic, are shifting their budgets from pure display advertising, which according to many studies, including the Pew Research Center, up to 85% of consumers don't see or interact with. There's a phenomenon called banner blindness, in which if you ask somebody, what ad did you just see on the page 2 seconds ago, they couldn't possibly answer you, to things like content marketing, brands creating their own forms of journalism and publishing, to native advertising, as Tim mentioned, which is this idea of advertorial for the web, and social media marketing, brands being present on platforms like Facebook and Twitter. Interestingly, a study Adweek did about a week or so ago showed that some native advertising executions at major publishers are being blocked by ad blockers as well. And native advertising, so this advertorial content, is also banned from the Google index. Publications can get in a lot of trouble if they let Google index and display those pages in search results.
Wow.
So while publishers are looking for more creative, more user-friendly ways to get commercial messages to consumers and to the consumers who might potentially want to see them, they're being attacked on a couple of sides, both from the Googles of the world and also the ad blockers of the world. It's a double-edged sword.
Sinan Aral with the Sloan School at MIT. We know you've got some big picture advice on how this on how to go forward here, but just describe for us in your big view what's at stake, what's on the line here.
Well, listen, I get annoyed by ads, just like a lot of other people on the web. But I think a useful exercise is to imagine a world without ads. And most people would consider this nirvana at first blush, but it's tricky for several reasons. So it's really a question about how we pay for the internet. If there are no ads, then free services today that we enjoy may become fee services.
Like and, what?
Well, for instance, imagine if Facebook tomorrow said, we're going to charge you $10 a month to use Facebook from now on because we're getting rid of ads, then a lot of people would have to make a very difficult choice.
Is that imaginable?
Well, I think that more and more publishers and content producers are going to paywalls and fee services and so on. I think a lot of it depends on how this debate ends up and where the evolution of the ad ecosystem goes from here. I think that in particular, it's sometimes we forget that ads serve an important place in the marketplace, which is to match consumers with products and to sort of make consumers aware of the long tail and the diversity of products that are out there. And this can really increase consumer welfare. As Tim said, I think this is going to hurt the small players the most because they don't have the resources or the sophistication to deal with it
the
as much as
the small players. That goes to the diversity, this cornucopia that we expect for free on the web.
Exactly right. One of the great things about the internet is what is known as the long tail, because publishing, because publishing is so low cost now, and the internet facilitates that low cost. Many, many more players, more opinions, more diversity of content can bubble up to the internet, be searched and found, and ads can draw attention to that long tail of publishing. But if publishers can't support themselves through advertising, then a lot of that long-tail content can go away, and we may get more homogeneity instead of heterogeneity in the types of things that we can view online.
And just less of it. What about the bigger players? Take the New York Times, big news player, heavy ad reliance in its vision of the future. Where does that go?
Well, you know, even for large players, they feel this as well. The New York Times has been struggling for many years with revenue generation, even without ad blockers, because ad revenues fall short. And that's why they've gone to a paywall and they're experimenting with how many articles you should be able to see for free a month and so on and so forth. And so I don't think this is exclusively a small publisher problem. But I do think that larger players have the ability, for instance, to support native advertising, which is potentially more involved and more costly than the programmatic buying of display ads that Rebecca was talking about. So I think that it affects the entire industry.
Our listeners are paying close attention online. Jim says, not too fond of advertising is the rattling of a stick in a swill bucket. Quoting George Orwell there, Tech Driver says, advertisers can go pound sand. We're paying for the data channel. And indeed, you're paying for that data access, and ads take up some of it. John, on the other hand, says, look, newspaper print ads didn't interfere with your ability to read the article. I don't mind ads that are silent and don't block content. Sanana Ra, please stand by with me here in the studio. Rebecca Lieb in New York. James is calling from Marietta, Georgia. James, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a former branding consultant for Interbrand in New York, oddly enough. But I really feel this is a problem of the ad industries, that it's their own creation. Those flashing ads that make it hard to read an article, or even the more nefarious on the mobile phones, the redirect to Apple's App Store to sell me Game of War that you just get all the time.
Yep.
I think it's really a tempest in a teapot. A lot of the ads are not, a lot of the apps for, say, different companies, they're not affected. You can see advertising within some of the apps on Apple right now. And there are even, I don't know if this is correct language, but white hat appeals, where some places are asking you to put them in as exceptions to, you know, to the rules.
Yeah, cut us out, exempt us from the blocking, and thank you very much.
Exactly.
But where does it go, James? Do you think it can be overall, that internet advertising can be made palatable enough that if it's so easy to do, users won't just block it all anyway to have that faster loading and less distraction from what they're going for?
Well, I think that's what people want in general, and I definitely want to stop all the redirects because I never know when that's going to happen. But there are sites that I would go through and support and put that way. And we have to remember, YouTube not that long ago didn't have very many ads in front of them. I don't know that Google, which owns YouTube, is necessarily hurting financially that they have to do this and or put 7-minute videos in front of a 2-minute clip.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem necessary.
James, I appreciate your call. You know the biz. I mean, we've all had the experience of waiting a long time, Rebecca Lieb, for that video to pass by before we get to what we really want. Do you hear online advertisers talking about really pulling in their horns? Or is that, you know, nice to talk about, but it's hard to do because we love putting out those big ads and we want people to see the whole thing? Will they really minimize their footprint if there's so much on the line?
Indeed, this is a question of advertising best practices, and it's not just the bottom feeder advertisers. It's also the larger players like YouTube who don't vary or frequency cap, as it's called in the industry, the pre-roll ad you see before you watch your YouTube video. So rather than see 3 or 4 different ads, which might shake things up, they feed you the same ad again and again and again and again, which is terrifically annoying to anybody who's wanted to watch videos sequentially on YouTube. It's the retargeting ads that are still trying to sell you that item that you bought on Amazon 2, 3, 4 years ago that won't go away. And it's, you know, this very precise, very targeted, or so it is touted, channel of internet advertising is too often being used as a blunt instrument. And that's coming back to bite the entire advertising industry in its behind. But unfortunately, it's hurting the publishers now much more than it's hurting the actual advertisers.
And of course, those publishers, very much including some of the biggest news organizations in the country. Let me go to Tibor in Akron, Ohio. Tibor, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I came from Europe, and I never seen a movie before I came to the United States with always interrupted with ads. So that was so annoying.
A movie interrupted with ads? Oh, you mean on television, Tibor? Traditional TV?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you can't watch a two-hour movie just without ads. That was like, what are they doing here?
No, here on old-fashioned television, a two-hour movie is a four-hour event.
Exactly.
So what do you think about the web?
Well, the web is great, and I used to search for white papers because of the ad. But I remember 25 years ago, cable and the web was free. And then now we're paying for both. Plus, we have to put up with watching ads. And the ads are annoying. Beside that, I usually go to Amazon when I want something. I don't think I bought anything in the last 20 years because they popped it up on my face.
Tibo, let me go to this issue of how much it costs just to have the service in the first place. Sunana Rawl, you can imagine, as those charges have grown for data and access, people saying, look, I'm already paying. Individual publisher, I don't care about you. I'm paying to have the web. This is so get the ads out of my face. That's kind of Tibor's line here.
That's true in terms of data, and it speaks to an important point about what type of ads we should have a norm around that are good quality ads versus low quality ads. but you're not actually paying the publisher for the content that you're reading. You're paying for the data that's coming through the network pipes, but that publisher is producing content at cost to them that you're receiving for free, and in essence, you are paying indirectly for that content because the ads are there, and that's how the publisher is getting paid.
We get that, but you hear Tibor, the perspective shifting. I'm paying for the data. Ads are data. I don't want to pay for this ad to come down to my smartphone.
Yes. Yeah, so, again, the content, that money doesn't go to the content producer,
yeah.
And that's the real problem. So we have the pipes that are being funded through subscription plans and data plans and so on, and then the stuff that flows through the pipes, which is the content, and that money is supported currently in large majority by ad revenue.
The Times and many others have plenty of what we're calling native advertising here, advertorial. In their print publications now, but also online as well. Easy to find right there on the homepage. Is that a long-term solution?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short-term problem is that the ad ecosystem has become incredibly low quality. So programmatic buying started in about 2010. You have these banner ads, which get an engagement rate of about 0.05%. They just don't work. And if you think back to about 15 years ago, we had pop-up ads that were coming up on the internet. And the industry and consumers and so on developed a norm around pop-up ads that said, we don't want these. And now you don't see pop-up ads at all. And so I think that there's a real opportunity for this crisis to inspire important reforms, both better ads, native advertising, content marketing, inbound marketing that are more effective, higher engagement, and higher quality. Also, low-resolution ads, no redirects, privacy-friendly or at least transparent, what types of data are we using about you to do these ads. But in addition to better ads, better ad blockers, not something that blocks all of the ads but is discriminating, that only blocks high-res or recurring ads.
People have been thinking about this for years. I was involved myself in a web company that is getting it going that would look at different ways to pay for what you really want. Lots of people looking at this. But now Apple's saying here it's easier. It's easier than ever for you to do this. And it's a challenge to an economic model that has supported the web, well, for a long time in web years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about ad blocking, bots, and mobile as mounting economic challenges to keep players, lots of players, on the internet, and in particular to sites that may bring you your news. I'm joined today by Sinana Rawl from the MIT Sloan School of Management, co-leads the initiative on the digital economy there. Rebecca Lieb is with us, consultant, research analyst, author out of New York. She's worked with Facebook and Pinterest and more. Sinana, talk to us about bots for a little bit here. These are crawling all over the web, automated little packets of software that that create the impression of a human viewing of an ad when nothing has actually happened. I'm reading here that in some of these ad campaigns, as few as 20% of the ad impressions or viewings were seen by actual people, 80% by bots, but people are paying for each one of those. How significant is that also in undermining the whole ad revenue model for the web?
Well, if ad blocking is really a threat to publishers, the bot traffic is really a threat to advertisers because they pay for this traffic, which happens to be bots, and some
the publisher comes and says 100,000 impressions. That they take that to be 100,000 people, but if it's only 20,000, that's a different story.
Exactly right. By some estimates, this costs the advertising industry in the several trillion dollars per year, up to $6 trillion per year.
And
that's a big number. And so so I feel like bot traffic, so buying eyeballs on the web, there's a spectrum. There are some in which you buy what are called low quality eyeballs, meaning you're paying very little for them and you're not really getting good people, but they're actually people. Mm-hmm. And then the lowest of the low in terms of the quality spectrum are those that are sort of under the breath talked about as not actually being people at all. And on some sites, this can be a very significant amount of the traffic total. And that's a real problem, I think, for advertisers.
Rebecca, is that cutting people's confidence, advertiser confidence? They don't even want to participate because they don't know what percentage of these impressions are actual human beings.
It's cutting advertiser confidence, and it's been going on for quite some time. There are also human bots, so to speak. There are click farms in Asia where vast armies of people are paid to simply mindlessly click on ads.
Oh, Lord, what a job.
Okay. Indeed. But advertising is a commodity, and we've seen the price of display advertising steadily decline, which is why there's been such a push for higher cost forms of advertising, native advertising being one. But then in the middle, there are things like video ads, which cost more. But we're also seeing other types of fraud, such as ads being served behind another window. So maybe there is a human viewer on that computer, but the person is physically unable to view the ad. The ad is served, but it's not actually visible. Now, this is a problem online, but I would argue that there are also corollaries in the real world. We've had DVRs for years. There are people answering the call of nature or getting another bowl of ice cream during advertising breaks in television. There are newspapers boosting their circulation numbers by leaving a copy of their publication on the door jam of every hotel room in America, and they can report to the Audit Bureau of Circulation that many issues went out when, in fact, they were probably promptly disposed of. So, what these problems
still, it's hard to compare to the way you can rack
online
up digital numbers.
Indeed, you can rack up digital numbers almost infinitely, which is very, very dangerous to the industry. So advertisers, publishers, and consumers are all locked in a battle that is going to have to come to some sort of resolution, but I don't see it being resolved quickly or easily.
Molly is calling from Columbus, Georgia. Hi, Molly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, in listening to this story, which I think is very interesting, I think about the fact I spend a lot of time on the internet, whether it's through my phone or through the computer, and I can't think of any time I have clicked on a banner ad or the ads that show up before YouTube videos. What I do click through are when companies do partnerships with social media accounts that I follow, specifically Instagram, Pinterest, or even Facebook.
Yep.
And they'll team up with, these smaller scale bloggers, a smaller audience, but because it's a little bit more targeted, I've purchased jeans because I see them on a blogger that I like. I have purchased many, many items for my daughter because I see them on blogs that I like. And I wonder, even if it's a smaller scale, if it has a higher success rate, wouldn't that be a better usage of advertising dollars?
Sinan Aral is shaking his head. How would it work? Can it work on a scale that would come in and supplant ad revenue?
Yeah, so I think Molly is sort of foretelling a rosier future in this more successful native or content-driven marketing. I think it's potentially scalable, but there isn't an ecosystem around it today that makes it accessible and scalable for all parties. I think that could certainly develop, and I do agree that this is the type of thing that more people are willing to have as part of the advertising system on the web instead of blocking it, and they're more likely to engage with it, more likely to click on it, and frankly, it's just more interesting. There are stories that are of interest to me. They are related to the platform that they're on, so they're contextually relevant, and I think that there is potential there for this to be sort of the better ads that could be inspired by this crisis.
So how do you do it in such a way that it doesn't just look like a corruption of the editorial environment? If someone comes to a news site looking for news, now suddenly you got lots of material there, content that's not news in the traditional sense. It's paid for by people who want you to buy something ultimately. How do you maintain the credibility or user trust?
Well, there's two elements of credibility that are important. One is the platform or the publisher on which the advertisement is hosted, and the second is the credibility of the advertiser or the brand that is advertising.
Yeah, but you know if they're an advertiser, they don't want you to buy soap.
Correct.
That's their ultimate interest.
Correct. But if I tell you something that is interesting – that is related to soap and contextually relevant to the place where you are viewing the ad, then it could potentially be interesting.
You're going to tell me if your soap has a dangerous chemical in it?
No, not necessarily. But imagine a content marketing. Take soap is a difficult example, but take the one that you showed at the top of the hour, which was the cooking example. Mm-hmm. So let's say that I have content marketing that is around how to cook or better recipes or tips in the kitchen and so on. That is useful to me and is sort of branded as being about a particular type of cookware or a particular type of stovetop or range. But the information that's provided in the ad is interesting, provocative, useful to me, in addition to it being about, you know, Wolf stovetops.
Rebecca,
whatever.
Does that work, or do you get the users over
it
time who see the whole?
It absolutely does work.
But why isn't the whole thing just one big advertorial then? And pretty soon, what do you trust? Because everybody's just out to sell you something.
Well, I'm going to step back a few paces and talk mm-hmm. about the goals of advertising. I think one of the reasons that display ads are so ineffectual is they have direct marketing metrics attached to them. It's click here, buy now. Mm-hmm. What Sinan is talking about and what I advocate as well in native advertising and content marketing are advertisements that establish deeper relationships with people. They inform, they entertain, they provide utility, and they nurture a buying cycle rather than say, click here, buy this now, add to cart. That is a very difficult mindset for companies to adopt. They've got quarterly goals, weekly goals, targets to meet. And so it's really about shifting the entire key performance indicators of the advertising ecosystem to slightly softer but still business-relevant metrics. One of the problems with content marketing and social media marketing is people look too closely at what we call volume metrics. How many likes did it get? How many shares did it get? And those are not the kinds of things that are really of value to advertisers. They don't indicate how did sales increase or how did we make more money. There are ways to fine-tune this. It just requires a different type of work and a different type of approach, rather than funneling creative into a programmatic ad system and doing a batch and blast.
It just sounds kind of subtle, maybe too subtle, just bringing the boatloads of money that it takes to run some of these organizations. Our listeners on Facebook, Brian, he's bailing all the way out here. It says, there are no ads in a book. Advertising has gone too far. Back to the library we go. But it's hard to go back. Everything is wired now around the web. Claire writes, maybe there needs to be a paradigm shift in the way that we pay for support content, particularly the news. Should similar sites conglomerate and offer cheap subscriptions? Well, look at that. Mark in Omaha, Nebraska. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I do not have cable. I have not paid for any kind of cable television in years and years and years. I use Netflix, Hulu, and YouTube for all of my television,
okay,
if you can call it that. I saw several days ago Hulu popped up and said, hey, for $3 more a month, no commercials. I could not have clicked on it fast enough.
So
it's a pleasure to me to not have to watch commercials. I will gladly pay $3 more. So if you're wondering if people will pay for it, I just did.
So you're lined up with Claire there. Offer me a way to pay something reasonable and just get away from the ads.
If it works for me, I'm going to do it. Give me the option and let me know what my options are, and I'll take the one that works.
And Mark's already done it with Hulu. I appreciate your call from Omaha, Mark. Okay, Sinan, what about this side of the equation? Is there enough ready subscription money out there for big publishers on the web to get off the advertising train and get on the subscription train? It didn't work in print. It depended on ads.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this has been...
Well, they had both, but they had to have the ad revenue.
Absolutely. I think this is proving difficult for the large publishers. The New York Times is a great example. You know, they've gone to this paywall. They're experimenting with this paywall. You know, the numbers, you know, you can debate about what the numbers are, but essentially what happened was that they went into a really big financial hole. The paywall clawed back some of that, but wasn't enough to overwhelmingly solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there is some need to have a multifaceted strategy from the publisher's perspective.
In other words, subscription, probably not enough.
Probably not enough in my mind. I think that if the ad ecosystem evolves into something that is more engaging, more fulfilling, and more useful, and publishers learn how to use subscription services well enough, then a joint strategy between these two broad options is probably the best way to go.
And if they can get past the Cold War, hot war with bots out there corrupting all the numbers around ad viewing on the web. Syracuse, New York. Bud is calling. Hi, Bud. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think one of the problems I see is that code that is written today is so inefficient because hardware is now so fast and cheap,
mm-hmm,
that the programmers are very sloppy. And it wouldn't bother me so much if things didn't take a doggone long to come down the pipe and load on my computer.
So the stuff is just too fat, too data intensive, and it doesn't need to be, you're saying, Bud.
Well, not just data intensive, just sloppy, inefficient code.
Yeah, which means doesn't that end up taking more time to load, more time to come down? It makes the user experience worse.
Much worse. I get tired of it.
Yeah,
ad blockers.
I mean, there's a reason right there. This should be a huge trumpet call to people who put these ads together. The Times actually, in fairness to them. Now, this is in their own story, but they tracked all these and they found their own ads with a pretty light footprint, but lots of players out there with heavy, sort of sloppy, as Bud says, ad software that's just kludgy and gums up the works.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you imagine a world in which ad blockers are discerning, in other words, they let some ads in, but uh-huh, they block some ads. Then it creates an environment in which there are incentives to create good ads.
Give me an ad if it's going to load fast and be a light footprint on my data feed.
And transparent in terms of my privacy and the data that they use.
Ooh,
and
I like that.
As well, maybe doesn't interrupt me or maybe doesn't pop up or move around and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we could have a sorting of high and low quality ads where the high quality ads make it through and the low quality ads don't. That's sort of the potential rosy future of a good ad blocking, good ad producing ecosystem.
There's a hopeful note
and,
there,
and
kind of win-win. What do you say, Rebecca?
Just to make another point to this coding issue, phones these days, mobile phones, have data limits. Increasingly, carriers are introducing new plans with data limits.
Sure.
And that means if you're sending a video ad to my phone and it starts playing automatically,
right, thanks a
I'm
lot,
paying for that bandwidth.
Yeah. So people want it lighter. They want it quicker. Do you see this working out, Rebecca, or is this going to lay waste to the internet ecosystem, the publishing world online as we've known it?
My hope is that ads get technically and in terms of content and in terms of user experience better, because otherwise it will lay waste.
How soon? Are we coming up on the edge of the waste already?
Well, it depends who you are in terms of how soon. The New York Times can hang on a while, so can the Washington Post. But what about that solo blogger who's, you know, just making beer money or just making rent with the ads on their site, and it's something that you enjoy, and it's not necessarily something that you're going to subscribe to? I think the subscription model has to be looked at, that, yeah, maybe we'll fork over a few dollars a month to the New York Times or to Hulu, but what about serendipity and what about discovery on the web? If everything's got a subscription paywall in front of it, then it's going to be very difficult to stumble across things that you like or attracted to and learn new things.
Sinan, in a word, hopeful here, or is this thing on the edge?
Hopeful. I think that we need to examine our cultural approach and our norms and decide as an industry what is appropriate and how we can move forward in a positive way.
But that means change.
Absolutely. I think change is one thing that is inevitable in this question.
Change or over the cliff here, maybe. Sinan Aral at MIT Sloan School of Management with the initiative on the digital economy there. Wonderful to have you with us today, Sinan. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Rebecca Lieb in New York, you're terrific. Thank you very much for joining us today, Rebecca.
Great to be here.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.